UK Wine Show, show number 212. Professor Chris Howe on Vine DNA. Good day, hello, and g'day to all you people out in there in sunny Podland. I hope your team's doing well in the World Cup. Welcome to this week's UK Wine Show for the 18th of June. My name's Chris Scott, and I hope you've been enjoying the World Cup. Now, I'm going to say it was a great one-all draw. No, I'm not talking about the English versus American game. I'm talking about New Zealand versus Slovakia. It's the first time that New Zealand's ever won a point in the World Cup, and it's only the second time in my life, I think the last time was when I was five, that they were last in the World Cup, so quite a long time ago, about 34 years ago. So, good on them. I think they're going to be out the back door for the rest of the competition, but at least after the first round, they're all even and Stevens in their pool. We're not going to talk about the World Cup anymore, but this week we're going to be talking with Professor Chris Howe from Cambridge University. And last week we spoke to Chris about how plants get their energy. And this week we're going to be talking about vine DNA. It's going to be quite a general topic about DNA and grapes. But first up in the show, we have our mystery region. Now, as usual, I'm going to give you a clue now. Then I'm going to give you a clue after the interview and then answer at the end. So the first clue is, our mystery region is on the eastern border of France and produces predominantly white varietals. It's a chocolate box region of half-timbered houses and ruined castles and fortresses, which has at one time or another been a German or French, depending on who won the last war. Some 2,000 mostly family-owned growers bottle and sell their own wines, although about 80% of the wine is produced by only 175 companies. The vineyards run through two departments, Haute-Rhin and Basse-Rhin, following the lower contours of the Vosges Mountains, which separate the region from the rest of France. Most of the best wines are in the south, southeast, and southwest-facing slopes in order to take advantage of the maximum sunshine in this long, cool-growing region. The more southerly Haute-Rhin tends to be regarded as producing the better quality wines. Now I'm going to give you another clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thank you, Chris. With many Bordeaux Chateaux this week releasing their 2009 vintages for sale, the early signs are that prices are reaching unprecedented levels. For example, a low-profile Margaux second growth was released at 150% higher than its 2008 price after receiving a high score from Robert Parker, and a Pomerol estate tripled its 2008 price and doubled its 2005 price. More major chateaux are preparing to release, but none of the first labels of the first growth have yet to lay their hand. There's been mixed reactions to the prices, with reports that wines are selling and orders are piling in for the 09 vintage, while other merchants, including several in the United States, are saying there's little demand. In Hong Kong, though, Berry Brothers is reporting that its entire allocation of Ponte Cane, a potential 100 Parker Point wine, sold out in less than 2 hours.
It may be a recession, but I also think it is a maturing market. America has only become a significant wine market in the last 20 or 30 years. But as the market's matured, they don't seem to have got swept away in the hype of the 2009 Bordeaux en Premier campaign. China is on the road to become a wine-consuming, and they have a booming economy. Now, they may suddenly change to buy Bordeaux en Premier, but more likely, the merchants are going to have to buy the wines and tie up even more cash, tie it up until delivery in a year or so's time. If this is the case, then supplying wines may achieve high prices, but at a higher cost. Longer term, if they don't come to the party, it could result in wines rising in price as the wines are released and the merchants have to pass on the higher cost of carry. But we'll only know that when the wines come up for sale and ultimately auction. Speaking of auction, what's happening in the auction market, Jane?
Well, with the Asian passion for wine intensifying, Hong Kong is fast becoming the world's leading wine auction centre. London's currently placed third, but New York is the biggest auction destination. Figures published by the South China Morning Post showed that sales could top $100 million in 2010, after the territory accumulated wine sales of more than $400 million Hong Kong dollars. That's just over $51 million. That was in the first half of the year. According to the newspaper, US wine auction sales have slumped by 36% to about $106 million last year, part of a global fall which saw receipts dip 15% overall to $233 million. The change is being driven by leading wine auction houses such as Christie's and Sotheby's, who are increasingly switching their sales to the Far East to secure higher prices for their customers.
It'll be interesting to see if they beat the American market. Certainly there's lots of hype about Hong Kong fine wine market, but Hong Kong and China's normal wine consumption are a long way to go before they catch up with Europe or America. One country that is trying to break into the UK market is Mexico. What's going on there, Jane?
The Mexicans are coming. Wines of Mexico has begun its operations in the UK to establish a stronger foothold and easy access to the best Mexican wines in the market. They're looking at opportunities in London and across the whole of the UK. Wines of Mexico promotes and commercialises award-winning wines from Baja. That's Mexico's chief winemaking region. And the PR says that Mexico is rapidly becoming the next big thing, with its unique terroir, focus on quality and commitment to small exclusive production. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website for these stories, 3050.co.uk.
Well, that does sound a bit like a PR person saying that, but I've never tried any Mexican wines. I'll be keeping an eye out for them for a while. Next up, though, we have the Spotlight. Okay, I thought in this week's Spotlight we'd take a look at the colour of red wines and how the colour forms and changes as wines are made and matured. The colour in wine varies depending upon many things, not least if it's a white or red wine. The key things that influence the colour are the grape variety, winemaking process, and the age of the wine. For red wines, the skin colour of grapes is determined by the type and the amount of anthocyanins. These chemicals are found in the skins of most grapes. These chemicals are found in the skins of most red grapes. Strangely, most red wine grape varieties are not red, but bluish or even black, such as Cabernet Sauvignon or Pinot Noir. Occasionally, other colours exist, such as crimson for Grenache. Once the grapes have been harvested and the berries crushed, the juice and skins are mixed. Grape varieties with small berries or thick skins will have more skin to juice compared to bigger berries with thin skin varieties, and more colour will come from them. Typically, most of the colour is extracted as the juice is fermented. Fermentation increases the temperature and the alcohol content in the juice, both of which help to extract colour from the skins. The anthocyanin colour from the skins reacts very quickly and becomes bound up with tannins to form pigmented tannins, which are far more stable than the red anthocyanins. Pigmented tannins can have a range of colours from orange to purple, but each colour is more or less stable, with blue and purple colours more likely to react and become colourless. So young wines often have a purple tinge which will fade to a bricky red as they age. Eventually, that red pigmented tannin fades, leaving a brown or mahogany colour. Not only do the wines fade because chemicals fade, but also the depth of colour will fade. Pigmented tannins polymerise, forming larger chains. Polymerisation is when just molecules chunk together to form big chains. And eventually, those large molecules get so large that they precipitate out of the wine and form the sediment in bottles of wine. And as they leave the wine, the colour intensity fades over time. Surprisingly, wines that have been exposed to oxygen during fermentation or during some subsequent aging will form more stable pigmented tannins, making the wine less likely to fade over time. So the colour of the wine can give an idea of the maturity of the wine. The deeper the colour gives an idea of the skin contact. That finishes the spotlight. I'll probably touch on white wine coloration in another spotlight sometime in the near future. But next up, we have our grape mystery region. I'm going to give you the second clue, and then I'll give you the answer after the interview. Now, our mystery region has quite diverse soils, which range from heavy clay and marl, which give more full-bodied and broader flavoured wines, lighter limestone and sandy soils, which give elegant and finesse, while flint and schist, shale and slate give the wines an oily, minerally, petroly aroma, often described as gumflint. Particularly important in the region is the pink Gray des Vosges subsoil. This is the Vosges sandstone which has been used in the area to build churches and cathedrals. The key grape varieties are Riesling, Gewürztraminer, Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Muscadet, Chasselas, Sylvaner, and Auxerrois. And these are the main grape varieties grown that pretty much all the growers grow. Even the smallest growers have a wide range of grape varieties. And of course, these wines are bottled in a traditional flute. Let's see how you get on with that. I'll give you the answer to our mystery region after the interview, which is coming up next, which is with Professor Chris Howe, and we're going to be talking to him about vine DNA. It's quite a large roaming subject, and it's quite loosely related to wine. I try and tie it into wine as much as possible, but it's quite interesting looking at DNA. Well, let's have a listen to anyway what he has to say about vine DNA. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Chris Howe, Professor of Biochemistry at Cambridge University. What we're going to be talking about today is more about DNA and genetics from a high level, but trying to tie it into vineyards and mm-hmm. grapes, etc. And I suppose the first thing is we're in the UK, and there's been grapes grown in the UK since Roman times, and we know there's been grapes grown in the UK since Roman times because we've found old seeds mm-hmm. in places all over the UK. No, not in all places, but in a few. Mm-hmm. Could we work out what grapes are grown from that?
In principle, we could get a lot of information, I think, because there are techniques now really quite well developed for getting DNA from old material, so-called ancient DNA or historic DNA if it's less old. And we're starting to understand now quite well how to get that DNA and how to study it. So provided you know something about the population structure of the species that you're dealing with, then if you can get DNA from particular samples, you can try to see how that fits in with the population as a whole.
How long does DNA stay active or useful to a person like yourself who's into extracting it?
That's a difficult question to answer because it depends very much how the material that you're dealing with has been preserved. So it depends on the conditions of temperature and how dry it is and so on. And also whether it's associated with other materials. So there's a suggestion, for example, that if DNA is associated with bone, then actually it may help to stabilize it against degradation.
What about seeds? Because seeds seem to be quite... I could see a piece of flesh just rotting away and going, but if the seeds have managed to stay together for a period of time...
Yes, in principle, then you have quite a good chance of being able to get DNA out. As I say, it depends very much on the extremes of temperature and perhaps if they've been through waterlogging and that kind of thing. So it's difficult to predict necessarily in advance whether you're going to be able to get DNA out.
Seeds have been found in ancient... tombs, you know, the Pharaoh's pyramids and things like that, where they're obviously been put there in, with an idea of preservation in mind. Would they be suitable, do you think? Or
some of them have been through a process of carbonisation, so they're quite charred and so on, and they would be, I guess, in a pretty bad state of getting DNA out. But others, if they're better preserved, you'd stand a better chance. It's a case of the DNA deteriorating over a period of time. So the older it is, then the more difficult it is to get good quality DNA out of it.
What about other processes? For example, I'm making some wine. You know, I've got alcoholic fermentation, I've got a bit of temperature there, all sorts of stuff. Do wine have any DNA left in it, or is it just juice and alcohol and the good stuff?
As well as the good stuff, there's also what I, as a biologist, would regard as good stuff. There is evidence for DNA being present in at least some wines that people have looked at. Yeah.
Would that be, like, some producers filter their wines quite heavily and they remove all solid matter, and that solid matter can be skins, fleshy bits. Mm. Is it that the solid matter you're after, or is it in the liquid itself?
It's probably in solution, because DNA itself is a fairly soluble molecule. You can dissolve it, and so it's probably just sitting there in solution in the wine.
The reason I'm asking is there's been quite a few scandals going on in Italy recently, and good old Mr. Silvio Berlusconi had to personally guarantee to the Americans that his wine was unadulterated that they were selling. Luckily, it was guaranteed by him, so we know it's all 100% right.
Of course, yes.
Man with such high integrity. But would there be a way of getting one of those old bottles or one of those Barolos or Montalcinos and working out if it's all from one grape variety, or do you think that would be quite difficult?
If you could get DNA out of the wine and if you could analyse the DNA and compare it with a known DNA fingerprints, so exactly the same kind of techniques that forensic scientists use in genetic fingerprinting. If you could do that, then in principle you could say it couldn't come from this particular variety, but it could come from this other variety. So that's a possibility, yeah.
Is it expensive to do? Because I think the way they were looking, doing it last time, was they were looking at the colour, and the colour just, the wines that were a bit iffy were just simply the wrong colour for the grape varieties that they were using, or supposedly using. Is it expensive?
It's time consuming as much as anything else. So the kind of experimental work that you're doing takes time to get the DNA, to get it into form that you can actually study, and then to do the analysis and get the conclusion. So just as, for example, I suppose genetic fingerprinting takes a bit of time, so in the same way, doing the genetic fingerprinting of the DNA in the wine would take a bit of time. As we understand better how to do the analyses, then you can speed it up.
Okay, so is it a function, like genetic fingerprinting, the police seem to do that all the time these days. Mm. In fact, you know, we were talking a wee while ago about Chardonnay's long lost parents.
That's right, yeah.
Nowadays, if someone thought I was a parent of someone, they can take a swab and know pretty quickly whether I am or not. So is that a case that's just been done lots and lots and lots, so people know exactly where they're looking in the DNA structure? And
that's right. In a lot of things in biology, the first time you try and do the experiment is actually quite difficult, because you have to work out how to do it better. And then over a period of time, you get used to doing it, and so it becomes much faster and much easier. And so I think it's at the stage of wanting to develop ways of making it more efficient at the moment.
Okay, so if it was a case that people wanted to go down this route quite a lot, then it could become, not quite matter-of-factly, but it could become an easier process.
I think it would become much easier, yeah.
If this was something that was done as a matter of course, is it a 12-hour thing, an hour thing, you just put it into a petri dish, add a drop of something, and it's done? Or what's the process in terms of extracting DNA and looking at it?
So what we do is we take the sample of material that we think has got the DNA in it, and we use a technique called the polymerase chain reaction, which is a way of amplifying particular pieces of DNA that you've targeted. And once you get that amplified DNA, then you have enough that you can start studying and start doing the more kind of subtle comparisons to work out differences between the DNA you've isolated from different sources.
And how long does it take to amplify up the DNA? Is it a overnight job, or is it a weekly, monthly?
The actual process of doing the amplification itself, this polymerase chain reaction technique, just takes a few hours, and you have a little machine, and you put it in the machine and switch it on and go away and have a cup of tea. And,
oh, my sort of science.
It sounds just like it. Yep, yep. And you can even go and have a glass of wine and then come back, and then it's all done.
And if you're checking out wine, could you just drink the results? Or
well, you have to be slightly careful, because the technique is so sensitive that actually just contamination in the atmosphere can be a problem. So people working on ancient DNA, going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, there have been a lot of problems in some studies, with certainly the earlier studies before people realized it was such a pitfall. There have been problems with DNA just floating around in the atmosphere, contaminating people's experiments and then getting amplified. This technique, in principle, allows you to amplify just a single molecule of the DNA. So it's really, really sensitive.
Once you've got this DNA amplified, and you've got lots of DNA that you can then experiment on and have a look at, what are you zoning in on and looking at, and what sort of process time does it take?
So you're looking for small differences in the DNA between different individuals. And DNA, as you know, is a repeating series of units that we call nucleotides. And those nucleotides come in four different varieties that we call A, C, G, and T. And so you're looking for slight changes between individual DNA isolates, where one might have A, one might have G, or one might have a repeating unit that goes A, C, A, C, and another one might have it going A, C, A, C, A, C. So those kinds of quite subtle differences you're looking at.
And is that in the chromosomes, because we've all got chromosomes, are you looking at chromosomes?
That's right. So that's little bits of DNA that you've amplified that are just a tiny, tiny fraction of the chromosomes in the organism.
Okay. If this was an everyday occurrence, we were checking it out from start to finish and determining the parentage of, or what's made up that wine in this bottle, how long do you think it would take if it was an everyday occurrence?
That's actually a very difficult question to answer because it just depends. As people do different sets of experiments, they gear up to do it faster and faster and faster. So an estimate of how long it takes now might actually be completely wrong in a couple of years' time.
Okay, so let's get the extremes. How long do you think it would take now?
If you have to start
on the spot.
If you have to start completely from scratch, then it may take months to do it, because you'd need to work out which bits of DNA you want to target and what the most effective way of targeting them is. So it could take quite a long period of time. But on the other hand, once you know exactly what you're needing to do, then it's the sort of thing that you could get results from in a couple of days or something like that.
A couple of days is quite fast, though.
So it gets much faster once you know what you're doing.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah,
it's like everything.
Yeah.
Okay. Just on a slightly different topic, one of the things about vines and grapes and all that sort of thing is that there's not a lot of sexual reproduction going on. It's all clonals.
Mm.
I've got a clone and I take a cutting and then I propagate it and I keep propagating it and it gets propagated from now until eternity. And so everybody's going, well, I've got exactly the same clone. But I remember from somewhere that your DNA actually mutates over time, even though the DNA in me now is probably different to the DNA when I was a little boy, and that's how things like cancer form.
Yes, you get changes happening in DNA, and you get mutations in the DNA in cells, and those mutations could be what turns particular cells cancerous.
Okay, so if I had a cutting from a vine that was 200 years old, it was a cross, a sexual reproduction 200 years ago, and I've got a cutting now, it's exactly the same clone as then, will it be the same clone? And do things, is there a variation or a wandering of DNA over time?
There are changes that can happen to DNA over time, yes, and they can be mutations, it can be changes in the actual sequence in the DNA, although the mutation rate is quite low. So over a few decades, then you wouldn't expect to see a great deal of mutations accumulating. We're starting to understand there are other changes that can affect how DNA functions, and we call those epigenetic changes. And there may be changes in the epigenetics of the DNA over a period of time that will affect how a particular clone functions.
I don't understand epigenetics. I've never heard of that.
So as well as the information in the DNA as simple units of these nucleotides, A, C, G, and T, there are other little chemical tags that can be added to DNA. We can have little chemical modifications, attachment of what we call methyl groups, for example, to the DNA, and that can influence how the DNA functions.
Obviously, sexual reproduction has a huge change from one generation to the next, whereas clonal variation seems very small from what you're saying, but there is some clonal variation. Is there a time frame that you think you could say, look, it's going to be thousands of years of clonal variations to make a significant or variation, or am I putting you on too tough a spot?
I have no idea what the answer is to that one, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't know. That's outside my comfort zone.
What do you mean you're a scientist? Especially having to shoot off the
mouth. No, I only talk about things that I know about.
Fair enough. Just talking about one last thing you were talking about. The worst thing that I can think of is, and it happened to me on Friday, is a hangover. You drink a bit too much wine and you have an absolutely stonking hangover. We were talking earlier about these chloroplasts, and you're talking about malaria actually originally being a plant.
Yes, or probably an alga rather than a plant.
Oh, an alga.
So it's interesting that, as we said earlier, in plants you have chloroplasts that are where photosynthesis happens, and they have a little bit of their own DNA. And a few years ago, people working on the malaria parasite, which is one of the most important infectious disease-causing organisms in the world, people working on that parasite found a strange little piece of DNA that they didn't quite know what it was. And with more detailed study, it turned out to be a remnant piece of chloroplast DNA. And actually, the malaria parasite has the remains of a chloroplast in it. It doesn't do photosynthesis any longer, but it does various other biochemical pathways that chloroplasts do. And that's essential for the parasite to function. So what happened in evolution was that the malaria parasite lost its photosynthesis, but has had to retain this chloroplast bit, which is essential for it. And that's really interesting, because if you have ways of interfering with how chloroplasts work, then they could be very attractive as anti-malarial agents, because you and I, as far as we know, don't have chloroplasts. So if you can attack chloroplasts, then that's a good way of targeting malaria.
And it would be hard for it to adapt.
It would be pretty hard for it to adapt. Of course, one never says it would be impossible, because things are very clever and find ways of mutating around drugs that you use. But it's an essential thing that the parasite has that chloroplast.
Fantastic. Okay, then, Chris, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I know the interview was a wee bit offline, but it does help to fill in some blanks about how DNA works. And the fact that you can use it for fraud prediction, if you wanted to, and put the effort in, that is, it's an interesting one. And maybe when more vines become genetically fingerprinted, you may see this becoming more and more used. Next week, in the week that Mexico has announced that they're going to be getting into the UK wine market, we're going to be talking with Brazil. They've been trying to crack the UK wine market now for about 4 or 5 years, and we'll talk to them about their experience as a South American wine producer producing wines. In fact, they're one of the bigger producers. They're third behind Argentina and Chile. All right, just to finish up though, we have our mystery region, which was, of course, Alsace. Those grape varieties, those German regions, the Vosges Mountains, got to be Alsace. And to finish off with, we have our quote. I thought this quote was particularly suitable. It was by a Dutch merchant who refused to be named, but he was quoted in Decanter News this week, talking about the 2009 Bordeaux En Premier campaign. And he said, "If the Bordelais believe that correct pricing means pricing to the very lip of a precipice, they have done well." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.